Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are rejoined here by a friend of the pod. First joined me way back in 2017, episode 30. And I've been a fan of his dating back that entire time, actually even preceding that. He also, of course, appeared last year in the midst of the Hans Niemann, Magnus Carlsen cheating drama. There's some more cheating drama going as we record here on December 4th. But we also have other topics to discuss, more serious ones, perhaps. And I am excited to welcome back to the program the award-winning author, grandmaster, and economist, grandmaster / doctor, David Smerden. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to catch up from all the way across the world. Never ceases to amaze me that you can join me from Brisbane, Australia. Here I am in my basement in New Jersey, and thanks to your microphone and the wonders of technology, you sound and look great. So, David, I definitely want to talk about your research. You recently collaborated with FIDE and some research collaborators and released a new index getting known for your chess indices. And I'd like to dig into that momentarily. But first, I'm just curious, David, as someone who probably has, you're more out of the chess world than in it, despite all the contributions that you get to make. If a non-chess colleague asked you what is new in the chess world here in December 2023, what would you tell them?
Yeah. Well, I guess it would depend on the colleague to some extent. There is a fair bit of crossover between academics, particularly economists or ones who are more in the mathy sort of fields, and chess. A lot of them play chess, keep tabs in the chess world, and pretty much everyone heard about the Carlsen-Niemann incident, for example. Most of my colleagues have seen the Queen's Gambit. So for the most part, I don't have to start from a bare minimum when I update them. And usually they come to me with something quite pointed, like, has anything happened in the Niemann story, for example? So it's pretty easy for me to update them on that. The good thing when it comes to chess cheating with my academic colleagues is that I don't just talk about the gossip that's happening on the Niemann case. I can go into a bit of the detail about detecting cheating, whether we're getting better or worse at it, algorithms, that sort of stuff, because economists actually care about this. The whole cheating and dishonesty research field was recently embroiled in controversy. I don't know if you heard about this at all, Ben. Did you ever heard of a guy called Dan Ariely, the predictably irrational?
Yeah, I was surprised because I was familiar with his research and definitely didn't expect him. So, I mean, you could speak to this better than I could, but basically one of the noted authorities on behavioral economics made up some data, or allegedly, I guess I should say, made up some data.
Yeah, that's right. Him and a colleague who is a very big name in psychology, based in Harvard, Francesca Gino, are both now under a huge cloud. And of course, the ironic thing about it, which the media loves to pick up, is that these were the two leading experts in dishonesty and cheating research and had written books about how everybody's a little bit dishonest if they can get away with it. And then, of course, it's almost comical that both of them got found out. So that's kind of like a field that I'm semi in. Like, I've got one toe in that field of research, and I'm bringing something novel to the academic debate because I'm using chess data to do it. Chess data is really handy to analyze a few of these sort of broader psychological theories about dishonesty and cheating. So for me, it's kind of, on the one hand, nice that I can connect these topics to something that's currently very topical within academia. But on the other hand, this whole controversy in the academic world is so disheartening to sort of like a, you know, an early to mid-career researcher like myself, because just to see that whole field just lose credibility in one big whack is a bit painful.
For sure. So do you think that you were more or less surprised than someone who would be like less of an expert on the topic?
I was more surprised, I guess. In hindsight, you know, hindsight's 20/20, I probably shouldn't have been. But the funny thing with that whole story, which is probably a whole nother podcast worth as well, but that they had so many high-level colleagues and collaborators on their teams. So it wasn't just one or the two of them publishing. And from what everyone can tell, all the rest of the co-authors are completely clean. So these are other professors who are writing the papers with them, might have been involved in the initial design of the experiments or design of the programs that were run with industry partners, and then later helped with some of the results and wrote up the papers and presented them around the world and all that sort of stuff, but never actually handled the data directly. And so that's a little bit concerning, because we often sort of specialize within our research team. So it's quite often the case that you'll work on a project where you're not involved directly with the data, and you're working with colleagues that are big names and that you respect. And that's a little bit different to the chess world, which is obviously more of an individual pursuit. And that's a little bit scary to me. You know, I never thought that such a scandal could go on for so long undetected.
Right. Well, it calls to mind one of the interviews I did around the Hans Niemann controversy, in addition to the one that I did with you, was with Grandmaster Alex Fishbein, where he just said that there's always been an element in chess competition where, like, yes, you try to catch cheaters, but it's also a game of honor. At some point, you know, you are making a leap of faith that the person is not trying to cheat. And I guess there's an element at that at play with this data as well. I mean, you know, you're presented this data by these esteemed researchers, so everyone probably kind of assumed that someone else checked.
Yeah, that's right. I should say that, so psychology have this big problem with what they call the reproducibility crisis, where a lot of their lab experiment data just wasn't being replicated in similar experiments around the world. And these are meant to be sort of fundamental psychological phenomena. So that was kind of a big deal. And that's led to a big movement now where you pre-register your analysis and you provide the data afterwards. Sorry, I say data. It's the Australian, you know what I
mean? That's okay, yeah.
Data. You provide it and everybody can play with it and try to reproduce it. So psychology's come aboard with, you know, they've come along with leaps and bounds in making it better, and science in general. I think one of the big things with the Dan Ariely and Francesca Gino scandal is that they were actually working with industry partners. Like in the famous example, they were working with a car insurance company. And so they were using internal real world data that was faked. And that's pretty hard to pick up. So for most studies, we, particularly in the lab, the norms have changed now so that it's a little bit harder to sort of fake that stuff, and people will try to replicate it. You know that that's coming. But with this sort of internal industry data that others are not going to be able to get access to, then that code of honor still sort of applies.
And I had seen the headlines, but I'm not super well versed in the story. Do you have a sense, like, was it that they tried it one way and didn't get the conclusion that they wanted, or was it more sheer laziness?
I think it's the first, and, you know, so there are court cases going on at the moment with this, so it's hard for me to speak with any, like, real authority, but the general consensus is, well, first of all, I should say that there's a team called the Data Collada Team, which is basically a bunch of academic volunteers who get together, and if you have concerns about a paper, they're essentially like forensic data scientists who go deep and try to look for evidence of manipulation or fraud or those sort of things. And they put in huge amount of hours of work into this case, well, actually a series of cases. And in the most famous example, the one with the car insurance company, the data was collected in an Excel spreadsheet. And what they could show is going into the metadata of the Excel spreadsheet, they could show that it had been tampered with, cells had been changed, and all of the cells that had been changed in such a way that strengthened the results. None of them went in the other direction. And one of the giveaway signs, one of many giveaway signs, but one of the most comical is that actually the ones that had been changed, the font had been changed as well. I think it was from like Collaborate to Courier New or something like this as well. So,
wow. Yeah. So again, goes so to show
that's a bit like a chess cheat getting caught in the toilet with a phone, right?
Yeah.
You think like, how could you be so stupid? It's so obvious. But then you think to yourself, well, if it wasn't for that stupid error, would we have caught you? You know, like that's right. That's the trade-off.
Wow, that's amazing. and on the topic of chess cheating, so listeners who didn't hear my conversation with Dr. Smerdon right around when the maelstrom was swirling last year, you had said towards the end that you hoped that at least something good might come of this, that there was more awareness of the cheating issue. And there's certainly more awareness as we record this here in December. There's accusations flying in every direction. But would you say that you see any good coming of the whole story as of now?
Oh, gee, that's tough. I guess, so let's start with the bad. So the bad is there are many more accusations being leveled now without really any evidence being provided. And I posted a tweet recently about this. There was a time, we can remember a time not too long ago, where that was considered almost a chess crime in itself, basically, to accuse someone without proof. And it's not just that's not just hyperbole, because there was a case where Sukova and others wrote a letter during a tournament. Sandu was the player accused of cheating. She was cleared of all allegations. But they signed this letter, and she was later hit with a ban by FIDE. I think it was a 3-month ban, and the other signatories, depending on their role in the accusation, were hit with sort of like warnings or something like this, something that didn't have much bite to it. But like the point is that FIDE took action against accusations without evidence, and just as a general social norm, we didn't really do that as chess players. Mama Diarov did it famously at the Aeroflot tournament in Russia and was sort of lambasted in the chess community for doing so. But the norm seems to have changed now. You seem to be able to do it with essentially zero repercussions. And I don't think that that's a good thing for two reasons. First of all, just as a general thing, accusing someone without evidence in almost any sphere is not good. And the second thing is that it is now creating this impression that a lot more cheating is going on in the chess world than probably is going on. And that's a bad thing, because we know from research, people are more likely to cheat if they think that more of the chess community is cheating. So that's like a social norm thing. You're more likely to be a smoker if you think more people are smoking. You're more likely to cheat on your taxes if you think more people are cheating on your taxes. So that's not a good thing either. Sorry, I said there was a silver lining. Do you want to hear the silver lining?
Yes, I am sure.
Because that was a pretty dark cloud. Sorry. So those are the things I don't like. But the silver lining is about Hans himself. To be honest, the attention that he got, I don't know about you, Ben, but if that had have been me, like let's just assume that Hans is innocent for the purpose of this thought experiment, which I believe that he is. Others
we
may
should
not,
say innocent from OTB cheating. We should
yes,
yeah,
sorry,
should
innocent say. From OTB cheating, innocent from the Carlsen example, and so forth. If I had have gone through what he's gone through, either I would have dropped out of chess, or my performances would have certainly been much worse. I mean, being able to play against top players where everyone thinks that you're a cheater, well, not everyone, but your opponent does, and a few others, I'm not sure I would have been able to handle it. And he, you know, he didn't have a fantastic tournament in the World Juniors, but he didn't do that badly either. That's an extremely tough tournament, the World Under 20s. And now he's playing well, I mean, he had the second best tournament of any chess player in 2023. He's doing pretty well in the London Classic. People can talk about his arrogance, his persona, and I mean, it is definitely loud, but the way that he's managed to fight back with his chess, to me, shows a resolve that if we talk about like personality and behavioral characteristics that can lead to a champion, having that sense of self-confidence and self-worth, you know, Nakamura's got it, Carlsen's got it. Seems that he's got that trait at least. So to me, that's potentially a silver lining.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. And just to give listeners a bit of context. So again, we're recording on December 4th. This likely won't be out for 2 weeks, David, so that they'll be able to look up how the London Chess Classic finishes.
Where that's right.
Three rounds in as we record this. And the story we're referring to, a lot of you probably have heard this, and you know, maybe more news or innuendo will have emerged by the time this comes out. But basically, Ivan Sokolov and Ivan Chaparinov, two of the grandmasters in the Croatian tournament, where, as David mentioned, Hans had a standout performance. They both made sort of very subtle, you know, sort of under the surface type allegations. And then even the organizers gave a statement where they said something like, and I'm paraphrasing, we have reasons for suspicion, but no evidence or something, which was, I thought, a strange thing for organizers who are the ones wielding, you know, the investigative power to the extent it exists, for them to come out with that publicly. What did you think of the way that all these parties handled this, David?
Yeah, well, on the Sokolov Chaparinov examples, I mean, they both had really bad tournaments. They both played pretty terribly throughout, and they wrote pretty soon after either the game or after the tournament finished, where, you know, grandmasters or all chess players really were susceptible to feeling a bit salty after these things. So I doubt anything more will come of this, and it's not for me to, you know, chastise them for their social media behavior there. With the regards to the organizer, a lot of these things, I always wonder how much is sort of lost in translation, particularly for non-native speakers. So the tweet said, or the post said something like, we have some indications, but no player has made a formal report or something like this. It's not really clear what indications mean in this. Like, maybe they're just saying he performed well above expected. There certainly doesn't seem to be any physical indications as far as I know. So I'd probably, without knowing further, I generally think that maybe language plays a bit of a role here, and that's possibly all they meant.
Okay. Yeah, that could be. I know that on, like, Tarje Svensson was the one who originally quoted it, and then there were all kinds of Reddit detectives weighing in and, you know, verifying the translation. But still, as you say, there can be subtlety amid that. And we'll get to your research in a second, David, but one other cheating story, just because there have been so many, and you are, and for better or for worse, an expert on this topic, the whole Kramnik Nakamura thing.
Yeah.
So I guess just for a brief explainer, again, listeners probably know this, but Kramnik basically said it, and was, according to him and his field of experts, it was statistically impossible, more or less, that Nakamura had won 40 games in a row and attained a new blitz high without assistance on chess.com. And these were not like big money games or anything, but he just basically not so subtly accused Nakamura of cheating. And chess.com subsequently came out with a statement saying they have no evidence. They've reviewed Nakamura many times. Ken Regan has given a couple interviews where he's also said there's nothing suspicious, but so I'm guessing I know your reaction, David, but I'd like to hear it anyway.
Yeah, I think with Kramnik, I'm not entirely sure what's going on with him. I know that his chess.com user profile is now becoming a de facto blog, where he's sort of changing his profile description every week as some sort of blog about cheating. A lot of this seemed to stem from something that happened quite a few months ago, where he made the claim. He said, backed up by mathematicians, I think he said, that he was much more likely to play cheaters on Title Tuesday than other top players, which was, I guess, kind of a curious claim, but he had some stats there. And interestingly, some data scientists actually picked up that claim, went through all the data, produced some really quite rigorous reports to show that Actually, it doesn't seem to be the case. At least it's not statistically different. The likelihood that he's playing cheaters and non-cheaters. His comment about Nakamura was also similarly a little bit curious. I think it was after Nakamura had some crazy like 43-game streak where he scored 42 and a half or something like this. But the interesting thing about that is that so the streak on the surface seems quite improbable. Like if you flip a coin 43 times, you're not going to get 42 heads. Like that's for sure. But actually some years ago, some researchers kind of just out of the blue cold emailed me some data about Nakamura and claimed that they had statistical evidence that he was cheating on Title Tuesday. And some of it was based along these sort of streaks. And I went through all the data and it is true that Naka has these streaks. That's some other players don't have, but nothing that is statistically improbable. So I didn't really see anything in there that was strong evidence of cheating. And my advice to them was kind of to let it lie and to drop it. As far as I know, they did. And then chess.com took Kramnik's allegations quite seriously and ran a lot of, I think, permutation tests on his streaks and also looked at some of the other extremely top players. So Carlsen's, Ferrugia, those sort of people. And their team, I've got a lot of time for their team. And I know that they also run a lot of their data past this. I think he's a Harvard statistics professor. And they came to the same conclusion. So I think it's good that chess.com took quite a rigorous approach to it. The same way that I did. You know, if someone sends me allegations and data, I won't dismiss it. I won't sort of accept it. I'll just, you know, it's data. Let's go through it and see what we get. Chess.com did the same. And I think that they showed Kramnik a fair bit of respect by doing that. But the conclusion just seems to be that these streaks will happen from time to time if you are at the, you know, extreme end of the scale, which Nakamura definitely is.
Right. Yeah. And we should also add that Nakamura is predominantly, because he's so good, like in the rating pool, he's predominantly playing people 300 to 400 points lower rated than him. So so it's a weighted coin to begin with. But
that's right. Yeah.
But yeah, there is something that strikes me that's sort of like behavioral at work where, as you say, once cheating becomes, if people think more people are cheating, then that can increase the instance. It just seems like there's some psychological element at work where Kramnik can't get it out of his head and it becomes like a sort of vicious cycle. So it's, and as you say, it unfortunately may not necessarily stop with him. Like they could go on to other accusations from other people.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. There's like spillover effects. And that psychological phenomenon that we have about sort of, I guess, being suspicious or more suspicious, I'm really interested in that side of things from a behavioral economics approach. And one of my very recent research projects is about that. You might have seen where I posted this kind of like a game where you try to guess if someone's a cheater or not set of chess games. And I'll sort of put a flag down on your schedule for 2024 that when the results are out, I'd love to come on. Definitely.
Yeah.
But one of the ideas there was not just to see what sort of players are better or worse at detecting cheating, but what sort of players are more likely to falsely accuse versus assume that someone's innocent where they're actually a cheater. So we've kind of got like a, you know, false hit rate versus true positive rate as well. And so that's what we're currently exploring in that data.
Okay. And I guess no conclusions can be revealed yet.
Otherwise, you won't have me back. So right. I'll I'll put a pin in it for now.
Okay. Sounds good. And last thing on this topic, I have to admit, David, I mean, obviously the whole Magnus Niemann story was a bit of a downer, but the repeated accusations, the online stuff is one thing. I mean, I do find it slightly disheartening, but it's a bit of a sideshow in my mind. But the fact that Niemann's still facing these allegations when he's under more scrutiny than anyone, and maybe there's secret evidence that's not being presented to the public, but none has been presented to the public. It really makes me worry for the future of competitive OTB chess. Do you share that concern?
Yeah, I am concerned.
I should say professional OTB chess, at least.
But. Yeah, no, absolutely. So if Niemann had have just, I guess, gone away, decided, well, that's me, chess is done for me, and left, in a sense, the chess world might have kind of assumed to itself that there was one bad apple that's gone away, which is probably not a good assumption. First of all, it's not clear that he was bad at all. And second of all, there are likely going to be other bad apples. So neither of those things are necessarily true. But the world might have just, the chess world might have just sort of said, okay, that's done. Let's carry on. But he's not going away, which I think, by the way, is incredible. And not only that, he's fast approaching 2700 again. He's still a teenager. There's every chance that he's going to be fighting for a candidate spot in the next 5 years. And can you imagine if this is sort of the world of controversy that we have at the moment around his chess and his tournaments? Can you imagine what it's going to be like if he's suddenly in an 8-player round robin vying for a world championship spot? I mean, that's what concerns me from a sort of a public lashing perspective anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. And I mean, apparently they increased the delay of this tournament. So that's one small measure. Are there any other sort of glaring suggestions you would make to make people feel a little less threatened?
I'm not sure. I sort of follow cheating in other domains as well as kind of like a topic of interest. Recently, there's been a scandal in poker. There was one a couple of months ago as well, but recently there's been a scandal to do with special contact lenses that combined with the right set of cards can actually lead someone to know what the cards are.
Oh, wow.
So technology is moving in such crazy directions that the delay was always there. If you've got a co-conspirator, basically, if you've got a co-conspirator who's online, that's going to help you then. There are other ways to cheat involving technology that most of us probably don't even know about yet that are going to circumvent the delay. So having that is sort of our, you know, it's like having a much bigger safe in a bank, like making your safe as big as possible with the front door, where when the robbers are actually just spending time on the person who's got the code to the safe. It doesn't matter how big you've got it. If they're not going to go through with a saw, if they're just going for the code, then that's still going to be a point of weakness. So I don't really know. I don't know what the technology is like at the moment, but I can't imagine that the delay is going to be enough by any means.
Okay.
Yeah, which is scary. I should say that no matter what technology is used, there's always going to be a place for statistics. I know that this has been criticized in the past. Fabiano's criticized the statistics from time to time, and I get that. The statistics will never be perfect. However, one thing I could say from these experiments that I've run, actually ran a cheating tournament where it was a real tournament for real money and I allowed people the chance to cheat from time to time. So this idea of smart cheating, where you can sort of occasionally cheat and sometimes throw in some bad moves to get around it, there are statistical ways that still do a reasonably good job at detecting that. So smart cheating is not as foolproof a thing as people think it is. And second of all, no matter how good your technology for getting engine assistance during a game, the statistics will still have some merit. It'll never be perfect, but it'll still have some merit. So I think that's one good thing, that we'll always be able to rely on statistics to provide some level of evidence about innocence or guilt.
Okay. Yeah, that is slightly reassuring. yeah, but it's the poker analogy is really interesting. I mean, yeah, as we've discussed, this whole idea that someone can just look just like you and I do sitting there and that you can no longer know if they're engaged in suspicious behavior. We've come a long way since the yogurts in the Korchnoi Karpov match.
Yeah, well, so they've banned all watches, and I completely get why they've banned all watches. But I don't know if you know about this. There are now currently smart glasses that you can just get. They're not like Google glasses or Apple glasses. You can just get them from your optometrist now. So they look just like our glasses we've got on right now, but they've got a little button and you can actually at any point press it and record a conversation that you're having with someone or record what you're seeing. So, I mean, what are they going to do if they ban glasses? Well, that's going to reduce the pool of chess players quite a lot, right?
Right.
So at some point, the physical stuff's going to get really, really impractical for organizers. Yeah. Anyway, I don't have solutions, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, let's move to a topic where maybe you do have solutions.
Good segue.
We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster David Smerdon.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. You're out with a new index related to how different, I mean, I'm sure inevitably you will explain it better than I will, but related to how women are treated within the chess world within different countries, and basically ranking. So just as you've done with the Fighting Chess Index, you have a Chess Gender Index. So let's begin with the basics. What was the genesis of this idea, David?
Right. Yeah. So this came about last year, which most people probably don't know was FIDE's Year of Women in Chess. And there were a few initiatives put forward during the year. One of them was to have these online forums between people who are interested in promoting women and girls chess in organizational roles or playing roles or just sort of random people like me, I guess. And I presented at one of them, and I tried to put forward some different policies that FIDE organizations, federations could think about implementing. And kind of one of the, I sort of put it as one of the low-hanging fruit that could be done is to put forward a gender in chess index. So indexes, there are heaps of them out there. United Nations, World Bank, a bunch of other places do them. You might have heard about Human Development Index, Global Corruption Index, Global Happiness Index, all these sort of cross-country indices. And they're useful. Most of the time they don't have bite, as in they don't affect laws or regulations or things like this, but they're there as a measurement of what's going on. You can compare across countries and regions. And most importantly, you can compare one country's progress across time. So they raise awareness about issues. People talk about them whenever the reports come in. Governments can set them as targets. So when they're putting in policies to promote something, like to promote gender equality within a country or to promote human development within a country, governments can put these targets and then you can track whether they achieve them or not. And also grassroots organizations within countries who are interested in a certain topic can use those indice measures as a way to build their profile as well and to put pressure on people who can make change. So there's a lot of like benefits to having it. The biggest ones, I guess, are just conversations and awareness. And I proposed it to FIDE. Earlier this year, FIDE said, yep, it sounds great. Can you go do it, basically? So that was the genesis of it.
Okay. Yeah. And you're out with a paper that basically summarizes the findings, but for those who haven't seen it, how would you summarize them?
Yeah. So the first thing that I should really try to make clear is that an index by itself isn't a research study. So a research study usually has a well-defined research question and usually does something affect something else. An index is a measurement. So that measurement tool can be used by other researchers, the UN's Gender Inequality Index, for instance, or the Gini, which is the Income Inequality Index around the world. They are used as a measure for many different research questions that can be asked, such as, do such and such government macroeconomic policies help to reduce inequality? We'll look at evidence using the Gini coefficient, the income inequality coefficient, and so forth. So that's kind of, we don't have those research questions in here. We're providing this as a measurement that other researchers can use. And I think it sounds like other researchers are going to start using to map the impact of different policies around the world, or the impact of kind of accidental interventions. For instance, like the Queen of Katwa movie, what impact would that have on Uganda and the surrounding countries? You know, that wasn't something that was consciously done by the Ugandan Chess Federation necessarily, but we can map the impact of, say, role models on women's and girls' chess by using this index and those sort of accidental interventions to track progress.
Yeah, so Uganda, as you mentioned, was one of the highest scoring countries. How do you pronounce the index, by the way?
Like the that's a good question. We've never had to enunciate it yet. So seeking your feedback on that, it's the Gender Equality in Chess Index, GECI. So it's either Gecchi or Gecchi, I guess. The latter sounds a little bit more Italian and maybe smoother off the tongue, but I don't have an answer yet, Ben. So what's your opinion?
Yeah, I'd go for the more Americanized sounding Gecchi. And here in the US, there's a big insurance company called Gecko that runs like countless ads during sporting events. So it's top of mind for us Americans, at least.
All right, Gecchi, sounds good.
Okay, but back to what I was asking before the Gecchi diversion. So Uganda, as you mentioned, one of the top scoring countries, and you mentioned Queen of Katwe, of course, featuring Fiona Matusi. So you're suggesting that there is a connection there.
Well, we're slowly starting to build up some suggestive evidence that there is a connection. So, you know, correlation's never causation, as academics like to say. If we look at the African countries, definitely Uganda performs best on this index, and countries that have a close connection to Uganda also do reasonably well. And you combine that with a research study that was done in the US last year, where they ran a randomized controlled trial. So that's a rigorous experiment where you can establish a causal inference. And what they did was they took high school girls in Uganda and high school boys, and they randomized them into two groups. One group watched Queen of Katwe, the others didn't. And then they sat their math exams. You'd think that it wouldn't have much effect. It wasn't sort of, they didn't sit it straight afterwards. They had some sort of time to adapt their behavior, study a bit more, that sort of stuff. And those who watched Queen of Katwa did better in their math scores and statistically significantly better, which is an astounding finding. And girls did much better. They sort of drove the result. So the explanation put forward in this research study is that it's a role model thing. You know, you don't try that hard in pursuits where you don't think that there's any sort of future career for you. But here you've got someone similar to you, a Ugandan girl who grew up in the slums, who did really well in a male-dominated mathematical sort of field that inspires you to try harder. So their explanation was that the role models increase effort and persistence. So that's one example. And it's an example which is relating chess to math. So it kind of makes sense that relating chess to chess would be even stronger. So I can't say for sure that it's a Queen of Katwa effect, but the evidence from, I guess, independent studies, if you will, seem to suggest that that's the case.
Yeah, even anecdotally, just thinking about what they call the Queen's Gambit effect, I do feel like there's been sort of an influx of young women, and obviously this is far beyond Uganda, but it does seem like a lot of women were inspired by that story, and Queen of Katwe, of course, is based on a true story rather than fiction. So all the more reason for it to have an impact. So what else did you notice about sort of any parallels between Uganda, Sri Lanka, and Mongolia, the three countries that had the highest indices, GACI scores?
Yeah, they're quite obviously, different countries. And one thing about cross-country indices is that all countries have their own different cultures or languages. I mean, they all have to be unique. That's why they're countries in the first place. But we did sort of interview leading female players and also federation officials from these three countries and countries that were quite high. Vietnam, Mongolia, and Uganda we interviewed. And there were some similarities in the sort of policies that they had in place. There seemed to be a strong focus on junior girls' development and trying to encourage them to stay in chess, particularly in the regional regions and not just in the big cities. There was some talk about funding, trying to increase funding, particularly for national teams. Another big one was trying to have female representation on the federation boards, on the administrative and executive board as well. So there were a few policies that give suggestive evidence that they may play some sort of role. Again, these are not causal things, so it may just be sort of correlations. But we decided to at least explore those a little bit. And our hope is that researchers will now try to go a bit deeper and to look at how different policies have changed things. We've already seen that happen a bit before this index came out. Some very good researchers, including one from Stanford, looked at the introduction of a quota in the French league, so French chess league. So it used to be, I think it was 8 players per team. They changed it to 9 players, where one has to be a woman. And what they did was they tracked the development in female chess in France and compared that trajectory to the trajectory of other EU countries. And that was trying to show a causal impact of that policy and how it helped not just women's chess, but all the way down to girls' chess. And so that was, again, a role model sort of story. So I don't have a silver bullet or really strong answers as to what policy is the most effective, but my hope is that by having this measure in place and particularly future editions of this measure, so you can look at change over time, researchers smarter than me will be able to come in and hopefully draw some, I guess, more concrete lessons.
Okay. But you do, through the stories of the women that you highlight, the women that you interviewed in the paper, I mean, there's certainly some, I guess you could call them, I guess conclusions might be a stretch, but areas to potentially pursue if we want to continue to yes. grow women's chess. So you chose, we probably should have said this earlier, but you're measuring this index by three components. So what are the components and how did you decide on those?
Yeah, so we tried to follow a little bit the model that the United Nations has as well, where it's got, with its gender inequality index, it's got three different components and it combines them together using a statistical mean called a geometric mean. The ones that we used, we called participation, performance, and progress. One thing that I should mention right at the top is that this index is measuring, a gender gap in chess within a country, which is quite different to saying which countries are the best to be a women's chess player. And I think perhaps there's been a little bit of confusion around that since the report was released, and that's probably my fault for not making it a bit clearer in the report. But if I was, if I was a woman GM and I was choosing a country to live in to pursue my career, I'd probably still choose, say, the Netherlands over Uganda, for example, even though Uganda is a lot higher on the list. So it's a little bit like which country should you live in if you want to be a women's chess player is a bit like which country's got the highest GDP per capita. That's kind of like the same sort of question. This one sort of saying, what about the gender gap within a country? So a bit like, what's the wage difference within a country? So for instance, some countries have a really high standard of living, no question, but they might have a big wage gap between the genders, or they might have a big unemployment gap. So it's a relative measure. And that's a little bit different.
And by gender gap, you mean the smallest difference in average average or median chess playing strength between men and women?
Yeah. So this is something that in the chess world is also a source of much confusion because gender gap is used to mean multiple things. When people talk about, you know, why are men stronger than women, or why are men better than women, or why is there a gender gap? It's not really very well defined. But researchers have chosen specific measures when they do studies on the gender gap in chess. They either use what you mentioned, which is the performance gap. So they look at the average rating of men versus the average rating of women and look at that difference. Or they do the participation gap, which is basically they look at what's the percentage of women chess players out of all chess players. And these are two different things, actually. And sometimes they're related, but sometimes they are unrelated. And so the good thing about an index is that I don't subjectively as a researcher choose which ones to put in. Generally, as a researcher, I don't like any decision that can't be objectively justified. That's sort of good research practice. So here, we know that academics are using these two measures, the average rating gap or the average participation gap. So why not put them both in? So that's what we did. So those two kind of go in almost as a default. Then there's a third one as well, which is progress. And the reason for that is that one of the criticisms of either the performance or the participation gap is that it doesn't capture things that are happening recently at the ground roots, a grassroots level of a country, because it's all based on ELO ratings. So you don't have no idea what's going on with basically boys and girls who aren't yet rated. And so it makes sense to have some sort of measure that doesn't involve ELO ratings and that focuses on the junior ranks as well to try to capture that thing that's missing in those other two components.
Okay. And are you going to continue to update this over time?
Yeah. The plan is every 2 years. I think that's a reasonable time frame. It also, it's sort of short enough that it's still relevant and that we're going to get enough measures to track progress, but it's long enough that a federation can set it as a target. A federation can look at its overall score, can look at its three components, say, well, we're not doing very well in this one. And, you know, different policies fit different areas of weakness in the indicators. So they might say, this is one we've got to improve. We've got till 2025 when the next index comes out. Let's see what we can do. So that's the plan.
Okay. And as you mentioned, like the Netherlands has like kind of a strong reputation, both for its rich chess history and, you know, strong woman players as well. But it scored low relatively on the scale. So why do you think it worked out that way?
Well, I don't want to give too many unsubstantiated opinions about this stuff. I would still make the point that this is not comparing, say, the Dutch women's team to the Mongolian women's team. That's not what this does. The Dutch women's team is a very strong team, very successful. They've got some really great players, particularly at the elite level. But their participation, if you think about a general open tournament in the Netherlands, their participation rates are way lower than Mongolia. I think I don't know exactly what the factor is, but it's a huge amount, a huge difference. And it's actually quite noticeable as well. If you walk around tournaments in the Netherlands, in a big hall, you can sort of point out the women, sort of like a guess who game. You could spot sort of like four or five dotted around different places. If you play tournaments in Southeast Asia, the first time I played there, I couldn't believe it. There's a female player on every four or five boards. You know, it's completely different. It's optically quite obvious as well. And the Netherlands is not alone in this low percentage. Most of Western Europe scores very low in women's percentage. And that's, if you're a psychologist, it's actually not surprising, because within social psychology, there has been a big and growing literature about this, what they call the gender equality paradox, which is that countries that on the UN's rankings are more gender equal in terms of rules, regulations, empowerment, that sort of thing, typically don't do very well on STEM-related female percentage. So if you look at, say, the share of STEM graduates, science, technology, engineering, that sort of stuff, every year who are women, countries in Scandinavia and Western Europe have low percentages compared to countries in Southeast Asia or Africa, which is quite surprising. And they've shown that there are also larger gender differences, so a larger gap for other things, even some to do with personality in these high gender equal countries. Now, we don't know why it is. That's why it's called a paradox. There are a lot of different theories that have been thrown around. Some of them seem like junk science to me. Other ones might have merit, but are not really substantiated yet. But what I would mention is that the results that came out of this index on the surface were surprising to me. But when I thought about it a bit deeper, were quite consistent with what's been found in a bunch of other fields as well.
Okay. And as you said, you know, some people are already starting to use these indices to generate their own research, which is what you want. But is there anything based on what your research and your interviews revealed, if someone came to you, say Dutch Women's Federation, since we were already discussing the Netherlands, and said, what can we do to help promote women's chess? What advice would you give based on your research?
So from a one country perspective, I think it's worth going into their data a little bit, which I've done with some countries in the past, go through the Dutch rating records. I should also mention one thing about this index. It would have been great if we could use non-ELO rated people as well and to get like a bigger population for every country. The problem is that data is often not available for some countries and very rarely comparable across countries. So we kind of had to stick to ELO ratings. But there's definitely a lot more to learn from, say, Dutch ratings and particularly from junior ranks. One thing that I've done in past research is I found that around about the ages of 16, 17, 18, a lot of people, or a lot of juniors essentially, stop playing chess. Like that's where your biggest attrition period happens. And it makes sense. You play for school and junior ranks and then you get a job and, you know, other things take over. But girls drop out at far higher rates than boys at those ages, which shouldn't happen. The rates shouldn't be different. And so something's happening around them and it's not the same across countries as well. So we can't just say it's a natural thing, if you will. There's something cultural that's going on. It could be that girls go from a period of being able to play in girls' tournaments, being able to hang out with their friends at school events and have that real sort of social utility or social benefit that comes with chess, to then going to a club where they're the only woman in a room of 100 men or something like this. And it may not be something, you know, nefarious like these sort of, sexual harassment movements going on at the moment. It may just be that you don't get that social benefit that you were getting before, and that's why you drop out. So I would suggest that a country go through its own data, have a look at that attrition period, try to work out at what point and in what circumstances are girls dropping out at higher rates, and then try to work out maybe through qualitative interviews or surveys, what are the factors that are leading them to drop out, because that's how you tailor your policies. You say, okay, if this is the reason why they're dropping out, then we can do things about it. We can set up girls' clubs that go on beyond school level. We can really try to make that infrastructure a lot stronger so that they're still getting that social utility.
Okay. It's interesting. I'm really glad it's great that FIDE wanted you to do this and that you did it. So thank you to you and your colleagues. We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster David Smerdon. And we are back. And do you have any other chess research in the works, David?
Somehow I've ended up with quite a few chess-related projects at the moment, which is really cool. I should thank my employer a lot because there are not many universities that would hire someone to be an economist and then suddenly find out they're spending half their time going through chess-based data.
Right.
I'm getting paid to do it, and I can't thank them enough for it. So I'm really enjoying the work that I get to do on that. I've got some exciting stuff that's probably going to be coming out next year. To do with not cheating and not gender for a change, but actually about nationalism and conflict. So a little bit to do with, I'm talking about sort of military conflicts, things happening in Ukraine, Russia, things happening in, Israel at the moment, but also Armenia and Azerbaijan, and how these sort of conflicts may affect chess players and even their style in games as well. So how it might affect their style and their their behavior when they play against people from different countries. So that's something that's, I guess, I don't know, it's probably not of interest to the chess world as much as the other topics, but it's perhaps more interesting to non-chess players.
It sounds interesting to me. And let me ask you, David, so I'm guessing for, you know, in your position as a professor, you, in addition to your research, teach some classes. Is that a fair presumption?
Yes, so, yeah, that's right.
Okay. So does the chess stuff come into your classes, or is that kind of like a separate bucket?
It definitely does come in from time to time. I think my philosophy when it comes to being a teacher is that it's good to choose examples that you're kind of an expert in, because then you can pass on some specialized knowledge that your students otherwise wouldn't get. So luckily for me, I teach two different subjects where chess comes into it. One is called game theory within economics, which has a lot to do with, as you can imagine, strategic games, chess being an example. And the other one is behavioral economics, where we look at gender biases, we look at dishonesty, we look at cheating, we look at all these topics where you can bring in, obviously, literature in other fields that are unrelated to chess, and we do that. But from time to time, we'll also go into some of my chess research as an example as well, which is quite good, because then when the students later propose their own topics, which they do as part of their final assessment, you know, sometimes they'll choose chess if they happen to be of interest in to chess. Sometimes they'll choose other sports or other games as well, or other fields that they're experts in. But they can sort of get an idea of the process about having a passion in some field, which obviously I do, some background in it, and then weaving that into a research agenda.
Okay, sounds good. And the last topic I had in mind, David, was actual chess. Now, I saw that you play maybe once or twice a year. How's that been when you get back out there? At least that shows up on your FIDE page when you get back out there and play.
Oh, it's tough. Yeah, I find it tough these days. You know, I got a couple of kids. I've got a zillion research projects. It's difficult to keep up. But I have a goal in mind. I'm a very sort of goal motivated person. And next September, so 2024 September, I think there's the Olympiad in Budapest in Hungary. I haven't played an Olympiad since 2016, which was when I played against Carlsen and when I virtually retired from chess. That was when I was board one. Now I'm fighting for board five, basically. So I'm fighting for that last spot. But I've got that as a goal. So I've played a couple of tournaments recently in Southeast Asia and the odd weekender in Australia. And I will throw my hat into the ring for that and see how we go.
Nice. Yeah, Budapest, that's a desirable location for an Olympiad, so I don't blame you. And for listeners who didn't hear our early interview, David told the story of not just playing Carlsen, but drawing him. So, and some fun details about like how to approach playing stronger players. And of course, you also wrote this fantastic book. Any other chess books in the works? It doesn't sound like you're awash in free time, but I guess you never know.
I've got a folder on my computer called Future Chess Book Ideas that I fill in every now and then, but I don't know if I'll ever get the time. The Swindler book has done really well. I've been really surprised with the community engagement with it. I think in general, people like the idea of come from behind victories and swindles in general. So I might write something on a similar topic in the future. It won't be exactly the same style, but still related to swindling. I do have this dream one day of writing a book that essentially brings the most interesting academic research that's done on chess all together for a chess playing audience. So that's the plan. Yeah. So I want it to be mainly for chess players, because basically like every month a new academic paper is being published that's related to chess, and the chess world never hears about them. Sometimes they're kind of not really related to chess. Chess is kind of just a means to an end. But other times, like the Queen of Cutwood paper, like that's semi-interesting, I think, to most people. And I'd like to, you know, sort of distill that in a easy to read book that might hopefully be interesting to some chess players.
Yeah, well, I think if nothing else, a lot of my listeners would be interested. They seem to enjoy it when I interview. I do too when I interview like academics, some of whom I have obviously a lot of chess chops, but others, even with less of a chess background. So, yeah, I think there's an audience for it. Well, great, David. While we have you here, any other topics you'd like to address, and or should we leave it until your next research, chess related research, is ready?
Well, I've already rudely tried to muscle in for another interview next year while on this live recording, so I won't push the envelope anymore. But yeah, look, it's been really fun to chat to you as always. I really like that you've taken an interest in this weird crossover that I've got between chess and research, and hopefully I can bring something interesting and potentially constructive to the chess cheating debate next time we chat.
Oh, that would be amazing. We need all the help we can get. So
yeah, we sure do. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again, David. Always great to catch up, and we look forward to future conversations.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, Ben.
Podcast Network.